Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In 2020, events have again shone a light on inequalities across the globe, and Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
I mean,
these comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
Yeah, but I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hello and welcome to Democracy Sausage Extra. I'm Martin Pierce and I'm here filling in at the barbecue hop late for Mark Kenny, who this week is on a well-deserved holiday. Democracy Sausage is produced by Policy Forum at the Crawford School of Public Policy and in partnership with the Australian Studies Institute. In July this year, all Australian governments committed to a new national agreement on closing the gap. It replaced and resetted the 2008 Closing the Gap framework. The new agreement includes four key reforms and 16 targets to tackle Indigenous disadvantage. The recent progress report found that only two out of the original seven targets were being met, namely in the area of early education and Year 12 attainment. Of the previous agreement, Prime Minister Scott Morrison said, "One of the mistakes that has been made is that we've looked at this as a federal government. We've decided what the gap is. We didn't look at the gap through the eyes of Indigenous Australians." He added, "That was wrong-headed. That wasn't the way to do it." And as a response, the government launched the new targets with the new plan, which was developed with and being implemented with the support of the Coalition of Peaks, which is a network of 50 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations. In a media release, the Minister for Indigenous Australians, Ken Wyatt, said the gaps we are now seeking to close are the gaps that have been defined by the representatives of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. This is as it should be. This creates a shared commitment and a shared responsibility. So today on Democracy Sausage, we want to ask, will this new approach lead to better health, social and economic outcomes for Indigenous Australians? And does this recognition of Indigenous leadership represent a step towards genuine reconciliation in this country? So we're joined today by two outstanding researchers and advocates to tackle these questions. First of all, I'd like to introduce Professor Ian Anderson, AO. He is the Deputy Vice-Chancellor, Student and University Experience here at the Australian National University. And before that, he spent 3 years leading these negotiations on behalf of the Australian government. And Professor Anderson is a Palawa man from the northwest coast of Tasmania. Hello, Ian. Ben.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining Democracy Sausage. And a welcome back to Dr. Virginia Marshall. Virginia is the inaugural Indigenous Postdoctoral Fellow in the School of Regulation and Global Governance and the Fenner School of Environment and Society, again here at the ANU. And she is a Wiradjuri Niyemba woman from New South Wales. Hello, Virginia.
Good morning, and Yirudu Narin.
So thank you both for joining us today. Now, with this new reshaped agreement, for the first time, First Nations people will share decision-making with governments on addressing Indigenous disadvantage. Can you tell us a little about what this agreement means to you? Perhaps if we start with you, Virginia.
Well, I think it's something that we've been waiting for a very long time. Prior to this acknowledgement and recognition of a shared decision making, we've been wanting to have Indigenous control, and this goes to our health, to our wealth, being on country. So that shared decision making is really part and parcel of who we are as Indigenous Australians. And I think this means an opportunity to be heard in a respectful way. Before we were going through many cycles of consultation, but the consultation was actually very shallow. And shared decision making means you come to the table, you have an equal say, there has to be time to listen and respond, but also it really deals with being heard. And I think that's really important. And it also sits quite well with the voice, and the voice meaning that you have that shared space where respect for the first Australians. We were the first and we are the first in the timeline. So I think that that makes sense.
What about you, Ian? What does this new agreement mean to you?
Okay, so I probably want to make two comments, both about its historical context and secondly about its implications for other mechanisms for Indigenous engagement. The first is to go back to when the original agreement was formed in 2007-2008. It was an agreement between governments, between the Commonwealth government and state and territory governments. But that, to get to that point, there was a social movement, and the social movement, particularly around Close the Gap, was led over about 5 or 6 years prior to that, firstly by Tom Calmer, who was then the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, but through a broad coalition of Indigenous and colleagues in non-government, non-Indigenous organisations. And it kind of, I think that when government then took it as an agreement between governments, they lost a really key bit of the social momentum for change. And I think that's particularly pivotal because the broad Closing the Gap framework is really a social, is a services reform agreement. And in essence, what, in making an agreement between governments, they were excluding the very large Indigenous services sector. So this agreement brings the Indigenous services sector, represented by the community controlled organisations, into sharing decision making about reform priorities and priorities for reform. I think this does have implications for other processes afoot, particularly around the formation of the voice. Now, the voice is a very different proposition. It's very important to recognise that. It is a proposition around constitutionally enshrining a mechanism for Indigenous Australians to have a voice to the Australian government. This is the Closing the Gap agreement is, in the old parlance, a COAG agreement, or a national cabinet agreement, whereas the voice is quite a different proposition. But I think the most important thing for it is that it shows that Indigenous Australians and governments can come to agreement, can go through the hard negotiations and form a joint view. So it's I think, very promising to show a way that you can actually do this. You can negotiate, you can negotiate in good faith, and you can get an outcome.
Now, you were involved in the negotiations for this agreement. Can you tell us a little about that experience?
So, over 3 years, there were kind of a number of things that were really important in setting out on that negotiation journey. One was to build a more scientific approach to setting targets, using data and evidence. The second was to try and to work in a way that kind of build a strength-based narrative for the broad agreement. And the third was to do that in with Indigenous Australians, working with Indigenous Australians. Now, we didn't get to the working with until probably to halfway through the agreement. The first half was done in a very traditional engagement consultative exercise. It was pretty extensive consultation. I think that by the halfway point, we had engaged with nearly 1,500 individuals over the continental landmass, and was getting very consistent feedback about the priorities. But then about the halfway point, the Aboriginal community controlled sector formed a coalition, and that was quite important. It meant governments could negotiate through a single mechanism rather than through multiple structures, and then put a pitch to first the Prime Minister and then to other state and territory ministers, essentially saying that we don't want to be consultant, we want to be negotiators. So that's quite a pivotal shift, and that really characterised the second half of the agreement-making process. So in that second half, we retested all the priority areas and target areas, and the Coalition of the Peaks really pushed quite a significantly firm line around reform and reform, system reform. So they, in the end, agreed to system reform along four lines: shared decision making, strengthening the role of the Aboriginal community controlled sector, data and sharing use of data, and Indigenous evaluation, Indigenous led evaluation processes, and finally the reform of mainstream systems. So the negotiations were quite different in the first two phases. One was an argument between government, and the second phase was less argument between government, but actually working with the Coalition of Peaks. So they were quite different dynamics, and a really kind of interesting and, I think, informative negotiation.
So let's get into unpacking the agreement a little. The National Agreement on Closing the Gap includes four key reforms, 16 targets, and new accountability mechanisms. And that replaces the agreement, as you said, from 2008. New targets cover a wide range of issues, from health to education to housing to land rights and the protection of Indigenous languages. Ian, can you tell us a little about what's significant about this new agreement?
I think that the kind of the reform framework is probably pretty significant, and as you alluded to and as I described earlier, I think it is a broader set of targets. They do cover the areas of unacceptable disadvantage, incarceration, child protection, but they also cover a range of areas where if we do better on it, we will actually put future generations of Indigenous Australians in a better space. So early childhood development, schooling, retention to year 12, participation in tertiary education. All those factors are fundamental to driving prevention and intergenerational change. And I think that the other elements, the kind of, this is more observational. With Indigenous non-government partners around the table, you get a fundamentally different approach to accountability. A standard intergovernmental agreement, it's the accountability between governments, Commonwealth and state. That's where the argument is. With a third party in this agreement, it's about the accountability of governments to Indigenous Australians. And I think that really pivots the accountability framework.
Virginia, two of the previous plan's seven targets were health related. The first was to close the gap on Indigenous life expectancy, and the second goal was to halve the child mortality rate. And 12 years on, those targets were not on track. The 2020 progress report showed the gap in life expectancy between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people was still 8.6 years for men and 7.8 years for women. And Indigenous child mortality remained double that of non-Indigenous children. Why was the previous agreement so ineffective in addressing that type of disadvantage for Indigenous Australians?
Well, I think it's overwhelming in the disadvantage that Indigenous Australians really experience every day. We know with COVID-19 there's been particular vulnerabilities that have played out across Australia and with civil society. So when we actually come back and we understand that disadvantage for Indigenous Australians has been really put in the back closet for many Australians and Australian governments for many years. And I think that the most important thing to remember is that we've had an extensive report by the Auditor General in 2019 that really pointed out the failures, not only in the approach of government, but as Ian quite rightly pointed out, was the lack of shared decision making. When we do have Indigenous peoples on a board, in the cabinet, if we have them across large organisations such as BHP and health organisations, we're going to make a difference, and we're going to really have a conversation that you will not have when Indigenous Australians are not at that table or not being listened to. And participation and also negotiation, which Ian drew also, is very important in this whole picture. So the Auditor General's report, in my reading, it means that we really were separate to any of the discussions on how our lives would move forward, on how to deal with incarceration. And the removal of Aboriginal children and Torres Strait Islander children across Australia is unacceptable. And even though we have the conventions, we have the rights of a child, we have women's rights protected under the convention, we have the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples that hasn't taken effect, that hasn't been incorporated in this country. It's been incorporated as a statutory legislation in BC Canada, for example. But we're so slow to take that up. But it's promising that the reading of what's happening now in that shared decision-making space with Indigenous peoples, that something like UNDRIP can then in time, and probably I hope in a short time, would be incorporated to protect those rights. And I think it's very important that for many years, 20 years ago, it was shunned by some sectors of government to actually incorporate international law. But until we have human rights and rights of Indigenous peoples being heard and incorporated into our legislation, into the fabric of civil society in Australia, we won't increase the opportunities for Indigenous Australia.
Now, of course, policy failures in this area don't have an abstract impact. They cost Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lives and livelihoods. Virginia, how do you think these past failures, some of which we've talked about already, reflect on Australia's political system and policymaking apparatus?
Well, I think one thing that I'm particularly interested in, and I've also been a practicing lawyer in that space as pro bono for Indigenous medicines, for example. In that space alone, there is very little research and development funding for Indigenous people to stand on their own two feet and to have a business and also to have control over their plants, biodiversity, and medicines that can really help the world. So I find in that space, Aboriginal people really need the support of government. And having that control of your life and true self-determination to progress research, progress businesses in those areas and bush foods is an enormous opportunity. And we can see that improving our lives as Indigenous peoples also means eating the foods from our country, the Indigenous foods, and also using Indigenous medicines, which many people in different communities are using today. They haven't patented these particular medicines. They're used quite broadly to help people, to heal people. And I think the message for us is well-being. So supporting research and development in these areas it really makes a big difference to Aboriginal people's health. And I'd like to see that discussion enter into the closing the gap. I don't think we really have drawn on these really important issues. And as we know, science is finding so many species that really provide good health and provide cures. And Aboriginal people need to be front and centre of that discussion and also involved in that area of their lives.
Ian, what about you? What do you think that these past failures, what do you think they reflect on Australia's political system and policymaking apparatus?
I think that there are, it kind of reflects some broad challenges around the capability in the public sector response to Indigenous Australia about how do you actually find a path forward that's informed by evidence, that's worked through with Indigenous Australians as partners, either in organisations or through other decision-making mechanisms. I'd make that as a kind of broad statement. My second point would be that in addition to understanding policy failure, we also need to have a lens that enables us to also appreciate and understand policy success. And this is what we learn when we take a more strength-based approach to Indigenous policy. So we do see success in it, particularly in the trends in early childhood development, educational trends, particularly in participation to year 12 and the growing numbers of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians who are coming into higher education, into the higher education system. And we need to understand why and what's driving that success. And then I think more generally try to figure out ways to build on some of the assets that are in the Indigenous world. The Indigenous world is not the same world it was in the 1970s and 1960s when Virginia and I were young. I'm assuming that she's roughly my age. There are many deep assets in the Aboriginal world. Native title and land rights means that, for example, particularly in the north, that Indigenous Australians have some form of title over 40% of the northern landmass, 40 and upwards. We have a generation of people who've had a chance to go to university, build their professional capabilities. There are doctors, nurses, lawyers, architects, and so on. We have significant Indigenous services sector, the community controlled sector, but we also have an emerging Indigenous business sector, and that's growing through policies such as the Commonwealth Procurement Policy. And so I think the challenges for us is how do we capitalise on those assets? Stop building policy that assumes that there's nothing of value in the Indigenous world, but build policy that builds on assets, that leverages success and enables us to then tackle those really tricky problems. And notwithstanding all of what I said, that, you know, incarceration, child protection are deep, difficult, wicked problems that we've yet to make significant success on. But we can do more if we take a different frame.
Well, I think Ian's correct in one way. It is a wicked problem, but on the other side, we have to have solutions. A wicked problem is one that we really don't know how to solve. But we do have solutions, and that strengths-based approach which Ian's talking about comes from the people itself, comes from Indigenous Australia and the survival of Indigenous Australia. I mean, myself, for example, I had 4 years of high school. I didn't feel very wanted when I was in high school. I didn't really appreciate much more than art and languages. I think that's what I really enjoyed the most. But, you know, I just didn't fit in that space, and I worked from the time I left school, and it was just something you didn't think about as going to university. And you didn't think about being in lectures or giving lectures or deciding to write your PhD thesis. So I think that it's great that young Indigenous peoples can actually imagine that space, even if they come as a welder or a carpenter or a mechanic. They can say, well, actually, university's got something to offer for me. And that's why I think, and Ian's pointed out these issues, we need to really provide all of those incredible creative opportunities and for them to see beyond what they've been stereotyped to believe is their lot, is their future. And I think for me the possibilities were provided by a number of really terrific people, and they were academics. And I think that we need to inspire people. When I go and practice at court, for example, in the Downing Centre in Sydney, I can see that there's no Indigenous judge, for example. There's very, very few Aboriginal solicitors that you can see at the bench, and I see very few people that go into private practice and, like myself, open my own firm in 2013. So, I mean, that is a rarity. And what I'd like to see is that that becomes common, that it's something like the advancement of women. We don't really have to talk about that anymore because we have equal merit and equal pay. That would be amazing. So for the same job. So I think that we need to have that really strong feeling to mentor. And I think that's what Ian has done over his lifetime. And it's certainly one that I really believe in, is mentoring. And there's so much value in that, because somebody can trigger, well, yeah, that triggers my imagination. That triggers my ability to think that I can do these things. I can be a doctor. I can be a lawyer. I can be a terrific audio engineer, for example, or a presenter. So I think that that's what we need to keep live in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, is that belief that you are greater than what people really stereotype you to be.
Well, I think you would be a terrific presenter. You'd be welcome to take up the seat from me anytime you wanted, Virginia. You've both talked there about a number of concerns and things that you'd like to see happen. Does the new agreement seek to address those? Do you think the new agreement puts us on the right track towards tackling some of those things?
So I had a close involvement in the development of the agreement. I think that it provides a really good platform for driving change, but it's not the be-all and end-all. I think that Indigenous economic development is a powerful change driver that governments really only indirectly have control of, so they can make it possible for Indigenous economy to flourish, but that is something which has got to come in part from within the Indigenous world. I think the same, too, I'd say, for cultural renewal and cultural development. That is something that has to be led from within the Indigenous world. And the agreement doesn't do that. It provides some of the framing for that. And then I think the broader process led for constitutional reform and the development of a voice to Parliament is a critical strategy that I think's a fundamental part of the jigsaw. So I think all these things are key parts of jigsaws, and not one element alone solves the problem. We need a multifaceted approach, but the new agreement is one part of that.
Well, I think that there's a good inclusion, and because I also practice in the native title area, I think that the inclusion of a native title in this whole process of the framework is really positive, because closing the gap, it must include water rights, it must include land rights. The only thing is that it's concentrated on traditional owners only, and it also really concentrates on how many determinations, whether they're exclusive or non-exclusive, will be decided for Indigenous Australia. So that's a bit of a question mark for me on, at the end of the day, how much control will Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have over sea country, for example. We've seen in the Bight of South Australia, there was a huge furor about taking gas out of, taking oil out of, out of the Bight. And that's a very cultural issue and a very deep and meaningful issue for Aboriginal people in that area, where they have rights over sea country, but their rights aren't listened to. So I'm just really hoping that those conversations will be really in the future in these areas, but it also won't only concentrate on traditional owners. This agreement will concentrate on stolen generations and people who are off country. They're on and living on other people's lands, and they can also be heard. And they also have recognition for looking after country, and they're incorporated, and their views are incorporated, because there's only, as Ian pointed out, there's an incredible landmass that's there, but there's also a lot of those parts of the jigsaw that are missing that Indigenous peoples don't really get to share. They don't get to have their country and their rights and exclusive rights. So that's one thing that I really will be watching in the future and encouraging. And also, you know, if you've got a roof over your head and you can do what you really want to do with your land and your water, it's a really amazing experience. You can really feel like you're living the life and living the dream, and that's what Indigenous people want to do. They want to go back and just feel a part of that earth and part of that water and be revived in their spirit. And it's just an incredible journey for identity. So who could really argue with that?
Well, that sounds like a great place to take a break. But join us for more, because when we come back, I want to dig into a little more about how the policy will work in practice.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. I'm still here with Virginia and Ian. And as I flagged just before we went into the break there, I'm interested in how the policy will work in practice. Of course, the new agreement has to be backed up by institutional and financial support from government. And after the announcement of the new agreement, the former Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, hit out at the current government for failing to put enough money on the table. Writing in early August, he said, "The announcement that the Commonwealth would allocate $45 million over 4 years is just a very bad joke. This is barely 10% of what the Liberals cut from our national closing the gap strategy." Now, Australia has officially entered recession, with national GDP slipping by a record 7% in the second quarter of this year. Ian, given the country's financial position, is there a concern that budgetary pressures mean that there might not be enough funding or to match the political will to adequately support this plan, meaning it could get kicked down the road yet again?
So that's a real risk. I think I'd make a comment that the landscape when Mr. Rudd, and indeedly it was a kind of a significant reform in COAG, and I don't want to take anything away from it, but it was pre GFC, so it was a completely different financial context. And I'd also make the point too that that agreement making occurred over an 18-month period. It didn't start with the money. It started with agreement around the targets. So I think that I want to give some space for governments to consider its fiscal response to the agreement. It is a very different context. And then I think that probably the other observation I would make is that there are better ways that government can spend its current investment, particularly around support for those ground-level, community-led initiatives. So one of the things that I would expect governments to do is look at how it spends its current resources, use the lens of the new agreement and ask the question, is there a better way to deliver change? Is there a better way to get money on the ground for those community-led services such as the community-controlled sector?
I mean, we do live in a very different time in terms of government spending, even from the time that this agreement was actually negotiated. Virginia, do you think that given that everything has happened in terms of the national debt that we've run up in terms of tackling the coronavirus crisis, that the government is prepared to put its money where its mouth is to properly support this plan?
Well, I think I also agree with Ian. There's a whole range of issues that have changed. Everybody in the world knows how their lives have been turned inside out by COVID-19. No vaccine, the vaccines that were offered, we're probably a little bit tentative about. So, yes, we are in precarious times, but that means that we actually have to do much more for people who are vulnerable and experience disadvantage. And we've seen prior to when COVID hit really our lives in a big way, that there was a big reluctance by the Australian federal government to increase Centrelink benefits. And it was only a small amount of money that we were seeking. But, the Australian government was pushing back saying that they had no money. So I think what we've got to do is remember that, we've had JobKeeper and JobSeeker and we've got all of these other different derivations of them. So there was money there to make a difference to people's lives. And I've lived on Centrelink before I started in tertiary studies with four kids. I lived 17 years in domestic violence. And I know, foregoing your food and your lunch or your dinner so you can actually feed your kids. So I think that, I look at that and I say, well, the government still has to push forward and say, we have to do more. So when times are more difficult, the government can't pull away and say, well, we don't have enough money. I watched the budget with Josh Frydenberg the other night, on Tuesday night, and I couldn't believe that there was very little for Indigenous people to get excited about. There was a mention of Aboriginal money going towards an education institution, but really looking through the budget papers, there wasn't much for Indigenous Australians, the first Australians. And as Ian and I have both said, have shocking statistics in closing the gap. And yes, we're hopeful, and yes, we don't want to talk with deficit language, but we have to be realists. If you're sitting in the chair and somebody's saying, well, I'm sorry, I've got to tell you as your treating doctor, this is really what's happening with you. Well, we need to say to the government, well, even though we're going through COVID and we've got more than $1 trillion in debt, we need to really make sure that our most vulnerable are going to be looked after. And that's really the reality. And all Australians just say, well, what are they doing for Indigenous Australia? Are we going to just wait again until times are improved and we've got a growth that we're going into surplus in maybe 3, 4, 5 years, 10 years down the track? We're not sure. So do we wait and just allow people to die and raise money for dialysis machines to have impoverished lives and no hope and you know, it's just all of these shocking things that you sort of think about and the possibilities that can happen after COVID and just us being more defeatist. I think we really have to be thinking about new opportunities but supporting people who really need that support, and that's Indigenous Australia.
Like you say, it was a big spending budget. There was a lot of money flowing out the door from government, but there was very little in there for Indigenous Australia. Does that make you concerned about the government's commitment to this agreement?
Well, I think it's like a marriage. You know, you're hopeful that your vows are going to be honoured, and I think that that's probably what Ian and I would love to think, that those vows will be honoured. And that goes to closing the gap and to all the other possibilities that are out there. But at the end of the day, who is prioritised? And I think that's what we're seeing in reality. And it certainly wasn't Indigenous Australia. And you know, the reply speech, to be quite even-handed, by the Labor government didn't really have anything either for Indigenous Australia, which was surprising. And the only last comment was that we are going to really acknowledge constitutional recognition through the voice. And that was the last comment at the end of the speech. And I thought, well, that's what we're used to being an appendage, and I think to history. And we really need to know that we are going to be on everybody's mind when it comes to these times, as are other Australians who are suffering and losing jobs and will lose jobs and will lose houses, and children will start and really move back home. And, you know, it won't be just a new normal. It will be a diaspora. It will be chaos. It'll be postmodernism. It'll be everything that we hadn't imagined, but we have to be prepared and we have to work together. And I think that we haven't been part of that picture this week, and I think we need to. I think they really need to rethink how they're going to actually work with us, like Ian and I have both stressed, in shared decision-making. We don't want people to tell us what to do. We need to make our own minds up and really discuss things as adults, and that's what the situation calls for.
Ian, there has been criticism of some of the targets, particularly around incarceration rates and for not being ambitious enough. Do you think these targets push policymakers hard enough to tackle some of the issues that we've talked about today?
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair call, but I would have to say that at the moment rates are going up. So the kind of, unfortunately, there is a longer, more intergenerational approach needed in the incarceration space, as in child protection. This is not something that will be fixed in 30 years. Absolutely. Based on our best kind of understanding of the drivers, one of the key drivers actually to incarceration is, child development. So you do better in child development over time, and this is how we'll have a generational flow. Incarceration rates will go down, as will child protection. But the challenge for that negotiation is that I think the Australian government doesn't have a lot of levers in the incarceration system. That is something that's run through state governments, and I would have imagined I wasn't at that part of the tail point of the negotiation where that would have been settled, is that the state governments would have been very nervous about. And I think that with all the targets, there was a genuine desire to push change, but also not set up future over the next 10 years of kind of reporting cycle of failure. So you've got to get the balance between building the political momentum and getting the balance around the best known evidence about how change will happen. In the end, it's a judgment. So the life expectancy target that was set in 2008 was never going to be achieved. Those who understand life expectancy as a measure and the drivers of life expectancy were providing that advice at that time. And the consequence now is that we've got year on, year out, kind of an off-track target. The key driver, Life expectancy will change and the mortality rates are changing, but it's not yet being picked up in the measure. So there's I think that one of the challenges here is that when you use targets in public policy, you use them to actually drive change, but they then this public discourse gets fixated on the targets. Are they on track? Are they off track? And no one's actually looking at the trends underneath that. And I think the trends tell a more meaningful story, both positive and negative. Yeah.
So moving on slightly, this year the Black Lives Matter movement has really captured global attention, and it's shone a light on issues like incarceration and police violence, especially in the US towards African Americans. Do you think this movement also signals a growing understanding of injustice towards people of colour around the world, including that which is experienced by Indigenous Australians, or is white Australia still not facing up to its history?
Well, the reply is yes. I think truth-telling is one of the really powerful explanations of why a lot of these issues that we're talking about today have occurred. There's been a lack of respect, a lack of interest in really valuing the senior knowledge holders and valuing the ability to really understand Indigenous peoples. And really, Black Lives Matter is always, in some form or another, really been a call to arms by Aboriginal people since 1788. All of those early diaries from Watkin Tench, from David Collins, for example, they were speaking about kidnapping Aboriginal peoples to observe them. So there's early research for you. And there's also been a whole period of time where Aboriginal peoples have really pointed out to governments, you know, even those colonial governments, and also some of the churches at that time of the shocking treatment of Aboriginal peoples. And there was committee meeting in England in the 1830s, I think it was 1837, and they were really pointing out that the murder and the treatment of Aboriginal peoples was unacceptable. So we've known for a long time. We've had our Black Lives Matters in Australia for a very long time, for a couple of hundred years. So I think that the shocking details of George Floyd, and I think we all felt that moment where we could see him losing his breath, and then people around the world wearing face masks, I can't breathe. That's happened to Aboriginal people where they've actually been assaulted by officers, where they couldn't breathe and they passed away. So I think that we have to really understand that this is a movement that we really can't let go of. We have to say, as you said, for African American, for people of colour, we can't stop the protest just because of COVID. There are other ways that we can protest that are safe and safe for everybody. We certainly don't want to go down to an American campaign level where people aren't COVID safe and they're not in a space where they can really protect themselves. So, but there is a protesting with safety that we can do, but we can't let go of this movement, because I think it's really important that every person counts. We don't want to have more than 400 people die in custody. And it is an issue, and we need to deal with it, and we need to really focus this as one of our aims too, is to change the way we do things. But truth-telling on all of the country towns that exist in Australia, of all of the history that Aboriginal peoples and Torres Strait Islander peoples have experienced, from blackbirding to be really working slaves in the marine industry in the Torres Strait, and also across different lands in mainland Australia. So we need to have hope, and hope is really that other people who aren't Indigenous will stand with us and really make a difference.
Ian, in your work at ANU, you work on strategic initiatives that promote equity and reconciliation. How can institutions like universities, including ANU, of course, play their part in the context of this agreement?
There's a very clear role for them in the agreement. There is a target for tertiary education, unlike the earlier agreement. So they absolutely need to address things in order to realise that target. There are a couple of key things for universities. I'll just focus on universities. Indigenous participation is growing in the university sector. We need to monitor whether that continues to grow in light of both COVID-19 and the most recent federal budget. We need to monitor that carefully. But we also need to address the significant lag in completion rates for Indigenous students. So it's good that we're getting more Indigenous students into university, but we've got to graduate them more at the same rate as their non-Indigenous colleagues. So that's really incumbent on us to look at the kind of academic and social and other supports that we provide them in the university community, as well as trying to ensure that the jobs they land after university are the best jobs possible. So, and that's a social capital issue about, you know, you don't come into university if you're an Aboriginal kid, if you're a country kid, or you're a kid from a low SES background with the same networks that other kids come from more privileged areas. The second thing that we've got to really focus on is building the kind of workforce that's required to deliver the service reforms that are outlined in the agreement. Do we have the teachers, the educators, the doctors, the nurses, both Indigenous professionals, but also ensuring that non-Indigenous professionals are fully equipped where they can to provide a high quality, excellent service to Indigenous Australians. And then finally, I think the kind of third plank is that we need to think through the kind of what the reform elements of the new agreement require in terms of Indigenous-led data management and Indigenous-led evaluation. We need to look at how universities can contribute particularly through a research high degree training to an Indigenous workforce in these areas, but also in data analysis and more particularly in evaluation methods. So there's quite, I think, some much more clearer and more significant expectations on Australian universities in this new agreement than there have been previously.
Now, we are coming to the end of today's discussion, but before I let you go, I would like to put a question to both of you, which is, how will we know that we are making genuine progress on the reforms and targets outlined in this agreement beyond those indicators that we have talked about? And secondly, what do you hope that progress actually looks like? Perhaps, Ian, if we start with you.
The data will be important, and that's the reason why you build a kind of a measurement framework around these agreements. But I think that equally important is some of the evaluation work that will be led by the coalition of PEGs around the actual agreement itself. Does the agreement live up to that shared decision-making ideal that was set out? So there are kind of more qualitative approaches to looking at, is the agreement working? Are Indigenous Australians fully involved in decision making within the context of the agreement? And then I think probably another issue that I'd be keeping an eye on is just the annual close the gap in the National Parliament. Are Indigenous Australians there alongside the PM talking about the progress that they've made over the last 12 months and what they'd like to do over the next 12 months, or are they outside the Parliament holding a separate rally on closing the gap?
What about you, Virginia? What is it that you will be keeping an eye on in terms of identifying whether progress has been made, and what's your wish for what that progress looks like?
Well, I would definitely say when we don't hear reporting about the increased rates in youth suicide, we don't hear increased rates of mental health and no support, Incarceration levels fall drastically low. Also that there are no or very few wards of the state and the removal of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. All of these different news items, policing, for example, you know, that Aboriginal people certainly are not up there being incarcerated and waiting in remand. So there's a whole range of different issues that I'll be listening to on the news and reading reports like Ian. That's really important that it is evidence-based, but also listening to the news and the media and reading and being across all of the different areas that of health and wealth, business development. I think seeing exactly and hearing exactly how Indigenous Australia is faring would be fantastic. That we don't have to listen to this deficit discourse. We just really listen to incredibly lived, good lives where it's not are you going to be an Indigenous doctor, are you going to be an Indigenous barrister, but, it's just being a human being. And I think that's really important that we transcend race, that we can still be Indigenous people. We hold on to our identity and our cultural fabric of what makes us strong, but we don't have to point out our points of difference. And I think that will be something that I would certainly wait for, and I hope I would live a very long life to see that. That would be wonderful.
Well, let's hope this agreement is a significant step forward in addressing some of those challenges. So thank you both very much for your time today. Thank you, Virginia, and thank you, Ian.
Mandanguwu.
Listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what we've talked about today. You can reach us on Twitter, where we're APPS Policy Forum, that's APPS Policy Forum, or better yet, join the Pod Squad on Facebook. We're Policy Forum Pod there, and we're looking forward to you joining the conversation. We'll be back with you on Monday with another episode of Democracy Sausage, but until then, cheerio.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.